Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and of course, all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Well, 2 days ago, an incident that may have further repercussions occurred in at the airport in Baghdad, and that was the assassination by the United States of one of the major figures in the Iranian military. This may have long-range consequences. This was the killing by a U.S. attack drone of General Qasem Soleimani, who was a senior leader of Iraq's the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, their elite military. Also killed, along with a couple of, standard bystanders or bodyguards or whatever, was a senior leader of Iraq's Shia militia. Now, this was done, and President Trump claimed credit for it, claimed he was doing the right thing. It was done, let's remember. There is no official war declared right now. It was an assassination of another country's senior military official in a third country. He was in Iraq. This Iranian military official, is Iranian. And he was on the way to the airport. Probably some sort of security lapse allowed the Americans to find out to exactly target him. Was this a good thing or a bad thing? I'll say I have my reservations about political assassinations when there isn't a war on. Imagine the American reaction had, a senior American military official, let's say the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, being assassinated, on his way to the airport in let's say, Paris, by, an Iranian sniper or drone. Now, the reaction would have been, this is war. This is beyond the pale. Now, it might be different if a war had been declared. General Soleimani, is regarded as an icon and a war hero in Iran, Also, he and his forces have done a lot to in the war against ISIS, which means he puts the Americans, puts us all on the same side. He has, and perhaps the Americans don't like this too much, the Israelis certainly don't, been key in supporting the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. I find it extremely worrisome. Not that I am a pro-Iranian or anything, but I do find it worrisome that this man was assassinated. Now we're told that he was masterminding some attacks on Americans. If that's true, and I underline if, that may be a reason. But we also know that the American government has perhaps a little less than complete credibility when it makes great claims in the Middle East. For instance, America, and indeed much of the Western world, the Coalition of the Willing, were led into a war in Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And the American government, then Secretary of State Colin Powell, the American President George W. Bush, lied to the world. They said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. That is, he had nuclear, he had chemical, and he had biological weapons. And that scared people. Now, I argued at that time, and I was opposed to that war. I'll tell you why. First of all, it was a war for Israel. It was taking out one of Israel's major opponents. And Israel was using the United States as its enforcer, or we used to call it in East End Toronto slang, a meat boy. A meat boy's coming. You're a thug, a useful tool. There was no reason to go to war against Saddam Hussein. For one thing, Iraq was stable. It wasn't a democracy. We won't kid ourselves. Saddam Hussein ruled an illogical country with an iron fist. And when I say illogical, it contained a number of different religious groups. Shia Muslim, which would be gravitate toward Iran. Sunni Muslim, who gravitate in general towards Saudi Arabia. A fairly large Chaldean Christian community. And a big ethnic minority of Kurds. A hard country to rule over. And he ruled with an iron fist. But he was also progressive in the sense that there were a lot of opportunities for women. Women became about 50% of the doctors and lawyers in Iraq. There was a growing middle class. And Saddam Hussein stood firmly against extreme Wahhabi fanatics like Osama bin Laden. In other words, he was a force for stability. Well, the war came after at least 600,000 Iraqi deaths. Not on the battlefield, most of these are civilians. But 67,000 American deaths. $2 billion, $2 trillion, with a T, spent to destroy and then start to rebuild Iraq. We now have a highly unstable government. We have a breakaway Kurdish area in the north. And we have something fairly close to civil war. Oh yes, and by the various radical Sunni elements, including ISIS, have driven most of the Chaldean Christians out of Iraq. Wow! What a victory! Now, we were led into this by a series of lies. The lies were that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now, those would be nuclear, chemical, and biological. It turned out that was a lie. A lie that senior American authorities knew was a lie. And was only on this basis that other countries, sometimes reluctantly, maybe with not a lot of enthusiasm, went along with the war effort. But it was a lie. Now, I don't have any reason to doubt President Trump when he says that this senior Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, was planning attacks against American units in the Middle East. But I also have a question mark in the back of my mind. Anything like that, any attacks like that, would be more likely to draw America into a war, a shooting conflict, which is exactly what Israel wants. Certainly, an all-out shooting conflict with the United States would not be what Iran wants. Assuming rational leadership. It would also, of course, not benefit them. They would almost certainly lose an all-out war with the United States. Victory, of course, would not be easy. Let's not kid ourselves. But the United States is bigger, has far more weaponry, bigger weaponry than Iran. So it would not be in Iran's obvious interest to go to war. Which makes me skeptical. But okay, back to Saddam Hussein and the allegations he had weapons of mass destruction. It turned out that was a lie. It was a deliberate lie. But who else has weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East? Well, Israel. Israel has nuclear weapons and has had for several decades. It has chemical and has biological weapons. And why would it be okay for Israel to have them, but not for Iraq? Well, that was actually never argued. Yeah, it turns out they didn't have these weapons, so maybe the whole discussion's moot. But I ask myself, why would it be unacceptable? Now, I can certainly see a very stern warning being given to the Iraqis and anybody else with nuclear weapons. Look, you've got those weapons. We really wish you didn't, but okay, you do. If you ever use them against us, that's the United States, and or our NATO allies, we will descend on you with the mother of all destruction. In other words, don't you dare ever use them on us or our allies. Now notice, I didn't say Israel. That would have protected America's immediate interests. America, assuming Saddam Hussein had nuclear or biological or chemical weapons. America doesn't want those weapons used on themselves. Of course, nobody does. Well, you simply give them a stern, clear, unmistakable warning from the highest levels of what the consequences would be should they use them. That was never done, of course. I believe that at the most senior levels, the allegations of weapons of mass destruction was a ruse to get to soft soap America into war. And it was a war that did not benefit the United States. It's a war that has cost an absolute king's ransom in money for no discernible benefit. There's a great Merle Haggard song that I play from time to time, America First. And there's a line in there, our highways and bridges are falling apart. I think it's our progress is stuck in reverse. It's time to rebuild America First. Now, if even half of that $2 billion had been used to rebuild, improve, expand America's key infrastructure, highways, bridges, airports, hospitals, how much further ahead would America have been? Instead, it lost a lot of credibility. It lost some troops. It lost a king's ransom in fortune, in treasury, in treasure. Okay, all these thoughts spin around in my head with this assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Was that the right thing to do? Was that the only thing that could have been done? I don't know, but it leaves me very uneasy. Now, one of the most informed commentators on international affairs that I know And he's been around for, he's been around at least for 40 years. Writes for the Toronto Sun and other media outlets. His name is Eric Margolis. He's part Jewish. He has extremely good contacts in intelligence and also in the Middle East. And this is what he wrote. The mafia would have been proud. The U.S. drone strike at Baghdad Airport that killed Iran's top commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and a senior leader of Iraq's Shia militia, has set the Middle East on fire. The Trump administration, which authorized the assassination, calls it a preemptive strike. Iran branded it outright murder. Soleimani was Iran's second most powerful figure and a national icon. He headed up the Quds Force, the elite branch of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, a key player in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and the Gulf region. Soleimani was also the most capable, intelligent, and effective military leader in a region of third-rate generals. The 62-year-old general distinguished himself in the long Iran-Iraq War in the early 80s, the dirty war in Lebanon, and operations in Iraq. He played a key role in defeating the ultra-radical Islamic State movement in Iraq, working in tandem with the U.S. Soleimani helped turn the tide of battle in Syria, saving the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who also would be the sole protector of Christians in Syria. Israel and the United States had a particularly vicious dislike for Bashar al-Assad. But if we looked at it from what's best for us, protecting the Christian minority there should clearly have been an important goal, and Bashar al-Assad helped do it. So in many ways, Soleimani assisted the West in one of the crucial battles, which was against ISIS. As a result of his battlefield and political successes, Soleimani earned the enmity of the United States, Israel, and the U.S. media. So many assassination attempts were launched against him that Iran's spiritual leader dubbed him a living martyr. His luck ran out this week, no doubt as a result of an intelligence leak in Iraq. His two-car convoy was incinerated by U.S. missile strikes, along with Soleimani, a leader of Iraq's Shia militia, was killed by the U.S. attack, as well as some 10 other senior Iraqi and Iranian officials. President Trump proudly took credit for authorizing the assassination, a brazen violation of international law. He seemed unfazed that most of the rest of the world see the U.S. as Murder Incorporated. For Trump, the killing will boost his standings with Republican and evangelical voters in this year's elections and promote his tough guy image. And Margolis does point out this from a man who repeatedly dodged Vietnam-era service and called for an end to America's Middle East wars. Now, there does seem to be a contradiction here, especially if this does lead to more hostilities, if not an outright war in the Middle East. Iran's cautious leadership may hesitate to retaliate directly for the murder. Tehran may choose an indirect method of revenge to avoid giving Washington the reason to attack Iran that it has been seeking for the past 2 years, at the behest of the Israelis, incidentally. The U.S. forces are spread across the Middle East and thus easy targets. Israel has long been itching to attack Iran's nuclear and military installations. An excellent new book, Rise and Kill First, by Israeli author Ronan Bergman, exhaustively details the long record of Israel assassinating Palestinian leaders and militants. As Stalin famously quipped, "No man, no problem." A large portion of the Palestinian leadership, mostly the most intelligent and moderate, was killed by Israeli hit squads, leaving no one to negotiate with, in Israel's words. Yeah, so you kill off the intelligent, moderate people, and then you say, but there's nobody sensible that we can negotiate. Oh, you know, so therefore, no solution to the problem. Of course, there are many factions in Israel that do not want a solution. Israel's decisive influence over Trump's administration means that the U.S. has fully embraced the same kill policies. Trump may now have the war with Iran he so obviously craves and that Israel and Saudi Arabia want. any Iranian retaliation will be branded as terrorism by the administration and its media sycophants. General Qasem was in line to become president of Iran. He was widely respected for his wisdom, religious faith, and clever diplomacy. He's now being removed. Trump's reckless policy may help his re-election, but it also makes it much more likely that the U.S. will sink even deeper into the morass in the Middle East. America has always demonized troublesome Middle East leaders that defied its imperial writ. The region's complex problems were simplified into cartoon characters that were labeled bad guys or terrorists. Think of Iran's President Mossadegh back in the 1950s, Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt in the 60s, Bashar al-Assad, more recently, Arafat, Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979, Ahmadinejad, the president of Iraq for Iran for quite a while, Saddam Hussein, of course, and now Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and more recently, Soleimani. More are sure to emerge. I think this is a very sober warning. And while I am no fan of of Iran or really of any of the Muslim leadership, I do think it's important to do our best to avoid war. In fact, we really should be doing our very best to get out of the Middle East. Here's an interesting and a not unusual situation. This is from the Detroit Free Press, I think. Yeah. He told police he was stabbed for being Jewish. Then his Apple Watch caught him in Hawaii. And this is from the Detroit Free Press. A 26-year-old man faked his own stabbing at the West Bloomfield Synagogue where he worked and then reported he was attacked because of his Jewish faith, authorities say. Now Sean Samet is facing a felony charge of filing a false police report, according to West Bloomfield Police. Police say that Samet's Apple Watch helped them solve the case. Samet was arrested on December 20th and arraigned the same day before Magistrate Julie Nelson Klein at the 48th District Court in Oakland County on one count of falsely reporting a felony, a crime punishable by up to 4 years. According to authorities, his $7,500 bond was posted by Samet's mother. On Thursday, he appeared at the 48th District Court for a probable cause hearing. He's expected to appear for the preliminary examination on January 14th. Anyway, the facts of the case. Samet reported he was attacked and stabbed in the abdomen by an unknown man in the parking lot of Temple Kol Ami, where he worked as a cantorial soloist, which is a music director. He reported the crime on December 15th, telling police that he was confronted about 7 p.m. as he was leaving work by a white male in his early 30s or 40s. Samet said the alleged attacker shouted, "You Jews, too many immigrants are here," according to the police report obtained by the Free Press through a Freedom of Information request. Samet told officers he was punched in the chest and abdomen during the encounter and he feared for his life, according to the report. He said he escaped by kneeing the attacker in the groin and pushing him away, then drove himself to Henry Ford Hospital, where security staff called local authorities about the attack. Police said the officer searched the parking lot for a weapon, blood, or other pieces of evidence, but came back negative. Canine officers were not able to locate the scent of the suspect. While searching Temple Kol Ami, detectives found bloody tissues in Samet's office and in the man's bathroom. They also located a knife in the kitchen area with blood on the tip of the blade. Suspecting Samet's wounds were self-inflicted, officers obtained surveillance footage from a house across the street and confirmed that no assault took place. Police said Samet admitted to making up the attack and said he lost consciousness and accidentally stabbed himself while he was washing dishes at the synagogue. He said he lied about the incident because he was being harassed at work about his medical condition. The second story also turned out to be fabricated. I mean, he's just a congenital liar. Officers were able to obtain information from Samet's cell phone health application that was synced to his Apple Watch, confirming he did not lose consciousness. Samet then admitted he intentionally stabbed himself. I put in the knife to see just how deep it went before, because I really wasn't really sure that in the process I would probably, I probably dug it in a little more. He told police he wanted out of his contract with Temple Kolami, and this was his way out. Temple Kolami executive director Cheryl Friendman told police that Samet had been an employee for about 1.5 years. A member of the synagogue also told the Free Press, Sean resigned on December 16th and there's no other information. When contacted by the Free Press, the Jewish Community Center of Metro Detroit would only say it takes these matters very seriously. Quote, we're also very grateful to our law enforcement in Detroit who take every hate crime seriously, Assistant Executive Director Heidi Budaj said. We are fortunate to have a partnership with the West Bloomfield Township Police who acts to keep our community safe. We are very disturbed to hear of incidents like this. Not only is it a crime to file a false police report, but those who commit such acts take vital resources away from folks who need help from law enforcement, said Carolyn Normandin, regional director of the Anti-Defamation League of Michigan. Quote, at a time when we were fighting real anti-Semitism, falsifying reports is destructive, and we strongly condemn such acts. According to the ADL, a false case could have a detrimental impact on those real victims of bias crimes. Samet's report occurred in the same month of two major anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. in Jersey City, at one at the kosher market that left 6 dead, including 2 Hasidic Jews. Anyway, well, this is a warning. We have, on numerous occasions, warned that many anti-Semitic incidents are self-inflicted for whatever screwball reasons. For one thing, the mere accusation that an attack occurred, a stabbing, not fatal or anything, and the reason was anti-Semitism. Some white man in the 30s or 40s came up and stabbed this fellow. And he even said, according to the story, you Jews, too many immigrants are here. Interestingly, the alleged quotation accurately blaming the Zionist lobby in the United States, which is in very large measure responsible for the massive third world immigration that has hit the United States in the past 50 some years. But this incident is a useful reminder that a good many of the alleged anti-Semitic attacks are simply bogus. They didn't happen. I'm not saying that they all didn't happen. Yes, some obviously do. But you add several things in here. Number one, a very gullible press. Press that will immediately take on surface value what is said. And police are only too responsive. Now, I know police have to respond to any report of a crime. If there's an alleged stabbing or assault, the police have to react, we know. I think in this case, the criminal, this fellow, Sean Samet, knew he's probably actually surprised that he's been effectively called out on this. The mere accusation that somebody, let's say a white supremacist, had, I don't know where, come along, stabbed him and attacked him, is considered plausible or believable. I'm not saying it never happened or could never happen. Of course it could. But we're very susceptible to the cult of the victim and the boo-hoo-hoo ideology. The next thing I'd like to look at is from Bedford, England. neighbors concerned and outraged after receiving racist flyers in Bedford. The flyers say, "White Lives Matter." And these flyers actually were in Ziploc bags and urged people for real activism. Bedford, I'm sorry, this is not Bedford, this is Bedford, Indiana. It wasn't what Kristen Hayes was expecting to find in the driveway. I saw a Ziploc bag that had a rock and a sheet of paper that was folded in fours. She said, just 2 years into the new year, Hayes said she found an unwelcome message that someone had left for her. It had a sheet that said, "White power, get some." And the swastika was in the middle, and it shocked me. Hayes explained, saying she thought someone had targeted her family in a neighborhood of Bedford's north end of town. "I do have a biracial son now." There's another one of those politically correct obfuscation words. It means mixed race. So I was really heartbroken, thinking it was an isolated case, she said. Turns out Hayes wasn't the only person with something waiting in the driveway. Other neighbors shared with Eyewitness News that they had received the same kind of plastic bags with rocks inside and other flyers with links to white power websites listed on them. Quote, "My grandson, 9 years old, came in with a bag with a rock in it and handed it to me," explained Denise Barnett, saying the flyer inside the plastic bag left on her driveway said, "No white guilt," while listing other websites linked to white power ideologies. We told the police, "We don't take this lightly. We're serious about this," said Barnett, explaining she called the police and made a report. Hayes also reported the flyer she got and said she knows of at least 3 other families in the neighborhood who received plastic bags with similar messages. This is a news story. Bedford police said they're investigating. Hayes said she hopes they can find whoever's responsible. She knows she'll sleep better if they do. If something like this happens, we can't stand by and let it happen. We have to fight back. What is this woman talking about? We have to fight back. You don't like the message? Well, put it in the garbage. What was the message? Well, let's see. No white guilt. And then with some websites. Well, there shouldn't be white guilt. The white race, the European race, has benefited more people with its technology, its health breakthroughs, its nutrition, its art, its architecture, its literature. We should not feel guilty. Indeed, no white guilt. Now, why should the police have to find the perpetrator? Whoever did this was communicating an idea. People, of course, are entirely free to accept it or reject it. Okay, that was one message. And the other one that upset the woman with a biracial son was a sheet that said, "White power, get some." And there's a swastika there. That shocked her. White power, get some. Well, you know, why not proudly assert your identity as being European or white? We really are in a cultural conflict between the followers of cultural Marxism and the various races who simply hate us and the rest of us. That even the assertion that you should be white power, get some, assert yourself, is somehow very offensive. Now, it doesn't explain whether this is a black neighborhood or not. If it is, I would say putting out such stuff is probably provocative. And I would certainly argue against anybody doing it, say, well, you know, you're not going to win a lot of recruits in that area. Well, why go to the effort? But the very fact that this is even controversial just tells us how on the edge things are today. A few years ago, drag queens would have been known to only a relatively small number of people. These are usually men. They're not necessarily homosexual, for some reason like to dress up flamboyantly as women. And they occupy a small niche in sexual subculture. There are people who enjoy doing this themselves or going to bars or places where they can see others who do that. And the drag queens enjoy a small niche on the fringes of entertainment. But now suddenly, drag queens are down in the elementary schools or in libraries reading stories to children. I would say, they should be boycotted. For little kids, it's just too confusing. Why is this, he sort of looks like a man, but dressed up like a crazy woman? You shouldn't have to explain that. And anybody, any authority figure who encourages or permits that, ought to be run out of town on a rail. Well, here's the story as to who's partly behind this. While the American Library Association is actively providing institutional support for the Drag Queen Story Hour programs, the tremendous funding it enjoys comes from a handful of very powerful Jewish activists and charities. Now, there's an old adage that if you want to get to the bottom of something, follow the money. Drag Queen Story Time as a concept was created by a Jewish lesbian named Michelle T. Tomasik and Radar Productions of San Francisco. Radar Productions is a Bay Area production company whose mission statement reads, Radar is a Bay Area queer literary arts organization creating and supporting a community of queer artists through commissioning, developing, and presenting groundbreaking literary work. Radar Productions is also instrumental in disseminating the program throughout the country. Radar is funded by a number of organizations, including the California Arts Council, that's the taxpayers kick into, the San Francisco Public Libraries, paid for by, of course, taxpayers, the Horizon Foundation, and notably the Walter and Elise Haas Foundation and the Zellerbach Foundation. The Walter and Elise Haas, that's H-A-A-S Foundation, is a Bay Area philanthropy founded by Walter Haas. Walter Haas is the son of Jewish German immigrants who married, he married Elise Stern, the daughter and niece of the founders of the Levi Strauss jeans. Haas is best known for being the president of Levi Strauss from 1928 to 1955. He's credited with saving and growing the brand. The Walter and Elise Haas Foundation focuses their energy and capital on five areas, according to their website: the arts, economic security, education, Jewish life, and net safety. The site prominently features articles like How the World Should Be, Jews, Social Justice, and Glide by Rabbi Michael Lezak. The Zellerbach Family Foundation is the other Bay Area so-called philanthropic organization that funds Radar Productions and Drag Queen Story Hour. The Zellerbachs are a wealthy family of Jewish immigrants known for owning a huge paper and paper and pulp conglomerate and enormous timber and land holdings in the Pacific Northwest. They are credited with inventing the folded paper towel and windowed envelope and were the subject of a 1958 antitrust investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice. The Zellerbach Corporation profited greatly during World War II when European paper companies were unable to export products to the United States. A huge portion of the Zellerbach Family Foundation's operating budget is also devoted to encouraging mass immigration and immigrant settlement. The Zellerbach Foundation has donated over $46 million to date and is devoted to building vibrant communities by supporting refugees and resettlement. And NGOs like the Tahiri Justice Center, which has served over 25,000 individuals supposedly fleeing violence. The Tahiri Justice Center Executive Director Morgan Weibel states, quote, without the critical support of the Zellerbach Family Foundation, Tahiri would be unable to continue its necessary work to support immigrants. If Jews are truly concerned about the alleged rise in anti-Semitism, one of the easiest ways of reducing it would be to abandon their relentless support of transsexuals and other sexual deviants having access to our children, including the drag queen thing. Of all people, the Jews should know the devastating effect that sexual predators have on children. As child rape is an epidemic in many Jewish, all of these ultra-Orthodox sects. This also explains why pedophilia is rampant in some Jewish communities and why Israel has become a mecca for internationally wanted pedophiles. Thanks to the insane ramblings of Sigmund Freud, Jews mistakenly believe that sexual liberation in children, and everyone else for that matter, is healthy for society, but when in fact society breaks down completely when promiscuity becomes the norm. Drag queens are part of the big plan some Jews have for healing the world, or Tikkun Olam. The other part is flooding our white nations with third world immigrants. And that's why these Jewish philanthropists fund both of these agendas. Yeah, and you know, some people will probably react with, you shouldn't say things like that. Well, all I need to ask is, are these accusations true? And this should be turned around rather than complaining. Well, you may make some people feel badly. In the words of Ricky Ricardo in the old I Love Lucy show, whenever Lucy did something really harebrained, Ricky would come storming home and say, "Lucy, you've got some splaining to do." Well, I'd say some of these Jewish organizations have a lot of splaining to do. We should demand to know how they can possibly justify these funding these subversive movements. You know, they should be held to account. And well, this time for my musical break, I'm going to take a short musical break right now, and I'm going to play some tunes that I hope you like. These are from some of the artists I have played before, people like...
If you have an old slow computer, you have to see this.
Merle Haggard and others. And I'm just trying to get these up on my screen. It's really giving me some trouble today. This is Merle Haggard. I love this song. This is America First. I think this really reflected what he believed, and certainly a whole lot of other people believe this too. This is the Merle Haggard Light, Merle Haggard, America First.
Solidarity, that comes the rest of it all. Yeah. think I'm blowing smoke. Boys, it ain't no joke. I make 20, 50 years from coast to coast.
Merle Haggard and America First. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to play a song kind of along the same lines. Merle Haggard actually has a kind of a cameo appearance in this. This is Gretchen Wilson, and this is called Politically Uncorrect. It should be probably politically incorrect, but we all know what it means. This is Gretchen Wilson with an assist from Merle Haggard. Politically uncorrect. Gretchen Wilson.
Must come down.
A trip to the grocery store or a tank of gas.
That's the family farm that's been in the family for over 100 years being sold.
They're not concerned about the violence and the death.
Seems like I have, you know, less money to spend.
Another deadly day in Iraq is 11 U.S.
soldiers.
I'm for the lone man on the totem pole.
Gretchen Wilson, and that was Politically Uncorrect. Here's a Canadian country western singer, Terry Clark, born in Montreal, grew up in Medicine Hat, southeastern Alberta. That's Terry. That's Terry Clark, and I wrap up this session with a song by a woman I met down in Nashville, Tennessee, years ago. This is Paulette Carlson, and she was the lead singer for Highway 101 in the early 1980s. This is Paulette Carlson, "The Bed You Made For Me."
Sung by an old true love of mine from Fargo, North Dakota.
I hear more from her on another date. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the Finding Side of Me. And you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf, Forever. This is Paul Fromm. And you're on the Fighting Side of Me.